Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Anthropology, a podcast channel of the New Books Network. I'm Alex Golub. I'm a professor of anthropology at the University of Hawaii at Manoa, and I'm the host of the channel today. I'm excited. Today, we're going to be talking to Anthony Hazard, an associate professor of ethnic studies and history at Santa Clara University. Tony, thank you for being on the podcast today.
Yes, Alex, thank you for the invitation. And certainly, thank you for taking the time to chat with me today.
Absolutely. So we're going to be talking today about Tony's book, Bowazians at War, Anthropology, Race, and World War II. So Tony, to get started about this book, maybe we just back up a little bit. Can you tell me about your early training and work and how did you come to write this book? What was the lead up to writing this book?
Yeah, so it really began with my undergraduate years at Arizona State. I remember taking a class with, enrolling in the class, not really knowing what to expect. But the class was Genes, Race, and Society with evolutionary biologist Joseph Graves. And in that class, maybe halfway through, he spent quite a bit of time talking about Franz Boas, Ashley Montague, Ruth Benedict, and this organization that I wasn't really familiar with called UNESCO, right? Mm. So this organization under the United Nations umbrella. And I recall, you know, leaving that class, going up to the training room, you know, walking over to practice. I was on the track and field team. I was a long jumper. But I just remember my days being filled with the work we were doing in that class. I had never been exposed really to the history of anthropology, to looking at race through that lens. And it was Dr. Graves who, you know, opened up that door and encouraged me to walk through it. And I carried that with me my junior year, senior year. I took a little break before grad school, heading into the first year of my PhD program in 2003. I knew in my heart, in my mind, that I wanted to write my dissertation on UNESCO. Of course, over the next 3-4 years, coursework and studying for exams, the project expanded, it grew. I then ended up, of course, defending 2007. The book, I work on the book during my postdoc at Northwestern, and then the book is published November 2012. But as I went through the process of revising the diss for publication, new questions arose for me, specifically concerning World War II. During my time as a postdoc at Northwestern, I designed a course called Race and World War II. And in that class, it was so much fun for me, because I have this history of military service in my family. I'm African American and Narragansett, and I knew that, you know, my father, as a Black and Narragansett man serving in the military, for his father as a Narragansett man, for my father's grandfather as a Narragansett man, there had to be a tremendous, tremendous conflict within oneself, right? To serve, to fight in World War I as my great grandfather had, to fight in World War II as my grandfather had, from my dad. You know, he enlisted in the late 70s and he served in Desert Storm. And just thinking about the individual stories, the experiences of Black and Brown people, but then this enormous historical context in which the U.S. military is fighting a war to defeat Nazi Germany and Imperial Japan with a segregated military, mm-hmm. right? With segregation at home, Jim Crow was still the order of the day. So to hear, you know, FDR speeches about four freedoms and the like, obviously there were so many troubling and challenging questions for Black and Brown people at that moment. And I had the opportunity to, you know, to explore some of those questions in the seminar. And from there, I said to myself, wow, I there's a lot there. I need to go back and and get back into the archives, get back to the Philosophical Society, you know, embrace, explore Boaz and Montague again. And that's where the book, the idea for the book came from.
Wow, that's fascinating. It's always so great to hear scholars who have passion and direction in their project. Mm-hmm. So much of the time when you're doing your dissertation, a lot mm-hmm. of people try to figure out, you know, what am I doing? I'm sure you had those moments too. Yeah. I mean, we all do. But I can see the strong intellectual connections between the two of those. Mm-hmm. And your book, you mentioned Franz Boas and Ashley Montague. The book also covers Margaret Mead, Melville Herskovitz, and, mm-hmm. and Ruth Benedict. Mm-hmm. But I imagine that, I mean, Boas is kind of the starting point for most of those people, although I guess maybe Montague had a slightly different genealogy. Maybe we should just talk a little bit about Boas. What did you find when you returned to the archive? I guess most people think of him as an anti-racist mm-hmm. activist, but mm-hmm. I think your story mm-hmm. is... Mm-hmm. complicates that or reveals some of the nuances there in that portrayal.
Yeah, that was, I mean, it was just a really great experience, you know, again, returning to the Philosophical Society. Philly is really my second home. And that's, you know, where I got my start doing, you know, real historical research. So going back and I wanted to ask tough questions of Boas, and I think Lee Baker kind of got me going in that direction. His, you know, his wonderful work From Savage to Negro, published in 1998. I wanted to kind of follow up on some of the questions that Lee Baker attempted to answer in that book, and you know, really get at Boas's own understanding of racism, not just on an interpersonal level, but I was really concerned about locating, teasing out if in fact Franz Boas had a kind of conceptualization of structural racism. Like, that was the big question mm-hmm. for me. And what I found was that, you know, for me, and compared to, let's say, Ruth Benedict, Ashley Montague, Boas left a bit to be desired in terms of his own understanding of structural racism. And even Boas, not being able to really make the connection between chattel slavery, colonialism, and quote unquote racial difference, right? As he observed it, he wasn't able to make those direct connections. And that came out for me in the archival work and in re-examining the texts that he produced, a few of the texts that he produced. So it was just a great journey, and something that of course had to be done when, you know, the person's name is in the title of the book.
Always key.
To start there. And the truth is, I was so far along with the Montague chapter, that, you know, there are places in the Montague chapter that I ultimately would return to, because I wanted to keep, after doing the work on Boaz and, you know, writing that chapter, I wanted to make sure that, you know, Boaz was, that the intertextuality was there, that, that mm-hmm. everyone else was talking to Boaz. Right. Even if they weren't, they still were, you know, through the work and through how they pushed some of his ideas beyond where he could go.
Right. So spell that out a little bit, that discussion of Boaz. I guess people think of Boaz as someone who proved that there are not stable biological races, and that mm-hmm. and that no one race has any greater aptitude for mm-hmm. genius or civilizational mm-hmm. products or intelligence mm-hmm. or something than other people. Mm-hmm. But and your take on Boaz is that somehow his critique of biological essentialism is not connected to, or is not accompanied by, an account of structural racism in the U.S. Is that what you're saying? Spell that out for people who haven't read the book.
Yes. So that's a part of it. Something else that I found that, you know, took me some time to process was that even Boaz was unsure, right? He wavered in his own belief about racial equality. There were moments in which he would argue that due to the equal potential of every race, right, that potentially biological, quote unquote, races and cultural development could occur and sort of reach the same heights, if you will, the heights of being civilized, right? So there were times where he would make the equal potentiality argument, okay. And then there were times where he would say, you know, he would just state it. And there was a talk he gave down at Atlanta University. He was actually invited by W.E.B. Du Bois to give a talk. And so he ends up giving two talks. The first night, he makes some remarks that are very much in line with 19th century typological thinking. This race developed in this way. People of African descent are not capable of reaching a particular intellectual capacity or capable of producing cultural, you know, products in a way that spoke to their intellectual endowment or their ranking or height of civilization. And then the next day, Boaz comes back and he actually refutes some of those arguments that he makes about the inequality of races. So he himself wasn't quite certain of either position.
Yeah.
Go ahead. Sorry.
I was just going to say, I wonder whether that is not him. I seem to remember that scene in the book. You know, he gives the first talk and then there's mm-hmm. kind of like maybe scattered applause. And then he thinks, right. I better revise for the second one.
Right. So the thing is, Alex, this appears in his works, in his written work. And that to me, again, was one of the kind of cool things for me as a historian to go back and just, you know, look at kind of some unknown publications of his, an article here, an essay there, and tease that out. And the uncertainty is there. It's there. But yes, audience, I mean, the Boaz's relationship to Black scholars and Black institutions, you know, it's pretty complex. And certainly he responded, when he was in those spaces.
Yeah, I wonder how much of this is due to his sort of unwillingness to ever say anything about anything. You know, is his is his sort of scientific scrupulosity holding him back from making a more straightforward point, or is he, or is this really a situation where he just really honestly is much more deeply ambivalent about African Americans than mainstream scholars would, or past scholars would like to admit?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. What I really got in terms of just the energy from him, he was, and I was able to locate this passion in some of his publications, yes, but in personal letters, right? The archive revealed a lot more to me than what I had seen during research for my dissertation. I think there was a genuine passion for doing something, you know, to move toward justice for Black people. I really believe it was there. I feel like I saw that in the archive. But in terms of his relationship to the discipline of anthropology, his relationship to, you know, science, I think that's where he was more likely to hedge and say, okay, so I've seen this evidence of cultural development here. You know, I can make the, again, equal potentiality argument that potentially races can develop, you know, to the highest heights. But I really believe that he was unwilling to make that leap. And certainly he doesn't, you know, go as far as someone like Ashley Montague.
Yeah. And I think that is also sort of connected to his relative. Let me know if I get this wrong about your book, but it seems to me like one of the things you're saying is that he has a sort of theory of biology, and he has a particularist theory about the diffusion of culture traits and whatnot, but he doesn't really have an account of social structure and inequality in the United States. And that brings it back to that point about structural racism we were mentioning earlier.
Yes, that's precisely it. And I think one of the things I was able to do effectively was kind of scaffold the depth of understanding of structural racism over the chapters. So by the time we get to Benedict, you know, it's been laid out that beginning with Boaz, you know, there was still some really crucial work to be done in terms of, you know, just in terms of you know, how not just these figures, but anthropologists and social scientists, you know, would come to understand what racism actually was, what racism actually meant, you know. It's always kind of, it's just, you get a funny feeling saying these things about someone like Franz Boas, but, you know, it's if anyone would appreciate getting as close to the truth as possible, I think it would be someone like Boaz.
Oh yeah, he's got that hard that hard jewel like flame, right? That's always burning in all of his writings. The jewel like hard, passionate flame. Well, you know, I guess this also kind of raises the question of what should we expect from scholars that we read about in the past, or you know, what would we think is appropriate? I know that there are some scholars who would say, you know, Boaz said that Black people were human.
Yeah.
And in the 1920s, that was amazing. And so he's a hero, you know?
Yeah.
Okay. So that's your response to that.
That's sure. That's fine. However, you know, we can ask more questions of Boaz. And I think it's completely fair to say, that his work was complex, and that he should be, you know, hailed for doing some of the things that he did, certainly. But, you know, for those of us who are historians and anthropologists and others interested in really excavating our contemporary understanding of race and racism, we can engage Boaz with, you know, with a critical eye. There's nothing wrong with praise and critique.
Yeah. Well, and I think if you compare him to other authors like Du Bois, mm-hmm. who admittedly were more focused on that topic than mm-hmm. he was then mm-hmm. that's also an interesting thing to do and remember. Mm-hmm. One of the things I really liked about this book was that you went through and read the book reviews of everyone. Mm-hmm. And you also pointed out the obituaries and how people were remembered, especially in the Black press. Mm-hmm. And Boaz, at least when he passes away, the immediate historical review is pretty laudatory. It's mm-hmm. yeah, it's remarkable.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think I got that idea from teaching my Malcolm and Martin class, mm-hmm. in which, you know, thinking about Dr. King and Malcolm X, the central question of the course is, why do we remember these figures the way that we do? How do we remember them? And who has been involved in shaping that remembering? And so I wanted to, you know, to kind of to do that for not just Boaz, but, you know, most of the folks in the book, because it goes to the historical memory of the discipline. And the Black newspapers, the historical Black newspapers, they're just, I mean, it's, they're just so rich. Like, yeah. It's so much fun to get in there and spend all of that time just reading through things. There's the political energy in the Black press, you know, through mid-century is just fascinating to me. So I had an excuse to get in there and do that work and include it in the book.
You know, I don't know if you've had a chance to read Bruchak's book, Savage Kin. It's about anthropologist's relationship with Native Americans. Mm-hmm. And she talks a little bit about how many of the things like adoption into local indigenous communities, which to anthropologists mm-hmm. seem to be a sign of proximity and mm-hmm. love and fellow feeling, mm-hmm. were sort of, in fact, communities' ways of dealing with interlopers who were going to be there whether they liked it or not. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. So it's not actually a sign of incredible intimacy and allyship that these people were adopted or whatnot. Mm-hmm. I wonder whether Boaz was sort of the person who was allied with the Black press, Black newspapers, and we should see his celebration in mm-hmm. terms of what the other available options were. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like mm-hmm. he was the guy who was there saying that, mm-hmm. But that doesn't mean that necessarily everyone was completely on board with it, or, you know, they couldn't imagine improvements in his position or something like that.
No, I think it's clear that it's fairly clear that for members of the Black press, you know, even someone like W.E.B. Du Bois, we could take Zora Neale Hurston, who, you know, studied with Boaz and Ruth Benedict. And these, you know, we're talking about like giants, intellectual giants in the Black community. They're activists in their own right, of course. And, you know, I do think it's fairly clear that there was a tremendous amount of respect for the work that Boaz had done, was doing, you know, up until, of course, the early 1940s when he passes. But there was also an understanding that the work had to go further. I think someone like, again, W.E.B. Du Bois, well respected for him, the anthropological kind of hierarchy or establishment was incredibly problematic. but he saw Boaz as someone who was doing the good work, who was pushing things forward. So as the Black Freedom Movement kind of accelerates during World War II, you know, there was, I think, a very earnest push to utilize quote unquote scientific or anthropological theories of race to buttress the freedom movement. And folks did look to someone who was, you know, very well known and established like Franz Boas. But of course, you know, things move forward and the movement shifts. And there was more work to be done. But it's, you know, this is something that is a reoccurrence in terms of the intellectual voices utilized by the Black Freedom Movement. Within the movement itself, there's a constant presence of that, again, praise and critique. Okay, mm-hmm. This is good, this is useful, but we could do more here. Let's move forward, let's push forward. So I think Boaz certainly was someone who kind of fit that mold for a bit for the movement.
Yeah. And another person who was involved with this was Ashley Montague.
Mm-hmm.
Montague, I think, is not as well known as Franz Boas. I mean, realistically.
Yeah.
Most people have not heard Franz. But in our little world.
Yeah.
And there's been a lot less historical research on Montague as well.
Right.
I think of him as, when I was in graduate school back in the day when there were still bookshops, you would go mm-hmm. and you would go to like the secondhand shelves
mm-hmm.
and there would just be, there'd always be secondhand books by Ashley Montague, a lot mm-hmm. of them.
Hmm.
So I always had a sense that he was someone who must have been important mm-hmm. and taught, because a lot mm-hmm. of those books, those paperbacks were assigned in college courses.
Mm-hmm.
But I think maybe his story has not received quite as much attention. Can you tell me about him and his work?
Yeah, so that is a book in and of itself, the Ashley Montague biography. This guy was fascinating. The first thing I'll say about him is that he was born to a Jewish family in East London, and first decade of the 20th century. And by the time, I'll try to make this quick. By the time he enrolls at University College London, he decides to shed his Jewish name, Israel Ehrenberg, and he takes on this persona of this aristocrat named Ashley Montague, right? So he literally is playing with his own Jewishness and whiteness as an undergraduate student. He keeps the name Ashley Montague by the time, of course, he, you know, enrolls at Columbia and embarks upon his own career. He's known as Ashley Montague, right? So there's the, and I'm playing off of Toni Morrison's work, Playing in the Dark, but Montague is playing with his whiteness, right, in mm-hmm. that way. Fascinating to me. And then we get to Man's Most Dangerous Myth, The Fallacy of Race, which he publishes in 1942. And in this book, he attempts to deconstruct race. Like before that term was a thing, that's precisely the work that he was doing, attempting to interrogate the very biological concept of race. And he was, I'll just say this and then I'll stop.
Okay.
He was, I could go on forever about Montague, but I want to give you a chance to get in there. He was really one of the first scholars to place the term race in scare quotes. He was really one of the first to attempt to undermine the concept of race in that way by calling out the very validity of the concept.
Mm. So he was at UCL and then mm-hmm. Columbia. So mm-hmm. when he studied anthropology in London, who were his influences to get him thinking this way? And then at Columbia, was he influenced by Boaz? And
so he was, I would say that, yes, he was influenced by Boaz. But he also spent some time at, slips my mind. There's another school.
Is it like the New School or something?
No, it wasn't the New School. London School of Economics.
Oh, the LSE.
Yeah, he spent some time there.
Malinowski land.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. So there we go. I would say that Malinowski was indeed an influence on him. Their correspondence is extensive. And I would also say that by the time he gets to, during his time at Columbia, it's Boaz, but in my reading of the archive, I think Ruth Benedict had a bigger influence on him and pushed him in ways that Boaz didn't, in terms of his understanding of race and in terms of getting him, Montague, to ask certain questions about race. And I'm not quite sure that I get to that in the Montague chapter, but just recalling my sense about the archive and Benedict's archive too, of course, at Vassar, the way that Benedict and Montague talked about these issues in the private letters, it's my feeling that Benedict actually had a bigger influence on Montague's thinking about race.
This must have been at the 1930s. You know, for most of the 30s, Boaz was ill and not as active, and Benedict was really doing a lot of the heavy lifting at the department. So maybe that's why that is that way.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So Boaz didn't put race in scare quotes, and Montague did. Tell me more about that.
Yeah, it's again so that it's difficult to draw a direct connection between what would have been Boaz's influence on getting Montague to that place. But I think that, and this is something that, again, deserves its own book, but learning more about Montague and how and what really happens with him from his childhood through his graduate training to get him to that moment in 1940 and 41, where he's making this move, right, to interrogate race in that way. I can't say that Boaz had that influence on him. What I think it was for Montague was just him being him, questioning everything in a creative way. I feel very close to Montague. I've worked on him from my first time I stepped foot in the city of Philadelphia. I think this was his creative way to interrogate race. And I will say I actually think that Julian Huxley, Elsie Dunn, Theodosius Dobzhansky, I think those biologists, geneticists, Elsie Dunn was an anthropologist, but I think their work in the 30s as they were trying to work out a synthetic theory of evolution, I think their work impacted Montague, again, more than Boaz.
Yeah, and so what is Montague's argument? I guess that's what I'm wondering. When you say that he puts race in quotation marks, what is his argument? And how is that different from Boaz's argument about race? What makes Montague's more powerful or novel or emancipatory?
That the very notion that human beings can be categorized into biological races was in fact a myth that science did not support the very categorizing of human beings into racial groups. Mm-hmm. Whereas for Boaz, there were races, there were biological races, certainly yes, with their own histories. Certainly environmentalism mattered and cultural relativism mattered. But for Boaz, there were biological races. For Montague, that was a myth. And for him to say that and to write a book about it, for Columbia University Press to publish it in 1942, I've always found that, to be striking. So that's the the key difference there.
And that's different. I imagine maybe with the Boasians too, one of the things you got a lot was that, you know, everybody is made of a mix of different races, mm-hmm. But I guess that's still a way of reinscribing the notion that there are distinct races. It's just that each individual is composed of several. I think that was lots of Boasians kind of held that view. Whereas, mm-hmm. and you still find that around today sometimes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Whereas yeah. For Montague, the whole category had to be scrapped.
Yes, indeed. Indeed. And again, it wasn't something that was being done. It really wasn't. I think another example would be Jacques Barzun. In 1950, he wrote a book with a similar title, something about the myth of race or something. And in that book, he places the term in quotations, scare quotes, as it were. But it was rare to see that done.
Yeah. I guess both Boaz and Montague were Jews who had mm-hmm. ambiguity. I should say I'm Jewish, so this is always interesting to me.
Yeah.
They're both Jews who didn't really identify strongly with being mm-hmm. Jewish, but still mm-hmm. somehow their experiences of Judaism and some sort of negative experiences, even though they lived in relatively liberal places at the time, mm-hmm. that somehow must have played into their biographies, but they took mm-hmm. very different positions as a result of that.
Yeah, so I mentioned very briefly just a bit about, you know, Montague growing up in East London. When he, there was an interview done in 1996, I believe, just before his passing, and he talks about, you know, being in East London, living, you know, as a Jew on the East End, and being chased and having rocks thrown at him, being beaten up. And at that moment, I suppose in that, you know, moment in his life, he felt comfortable or even compelled to describe those childhood experiences, and how that, you know, that violent environment for Jewish people impacted him as, you know, obviously as a human, but as a thinker, as a scholar. And it still bothers me that I haven't been able to to go to the UK, to go, you know, to go to London and just investigate that part of his life more. You know, the ways that this is something else I could go on about, but the ways that some of his critics invoke his Jewishness at times is also fascinating to me, because in a way he was, as he played with his whiteness and Jewishness, at times he did want to hide, you know, he wanted to hide his Jewishness. But then in other moments, he embraced it. So there's just so much there with Montague.
You know what I would love to see? I would love to see what the correspondence between him and Malinowski is like. You know, Malinowski mm-hmm. made a point of never being boring. And I imagine there must be a lot of gossip in there. Yeah,
yeah, and that's the whole thing, to get back to LSE. You know, and read those letters, because there isn't a lot in the Montague archive in Philly.
Yeah. You know, one of the other authors that you cover in the book is Herskovitz. Mm-hmm. And I was struck in the chapter on Herskovitz, you almost sort of place him not so much as a Boasian mm-hmm. as a Du Boisian, that he mm-hmm. was, he would, if he himself was not directly educated in that tradition, almost all of his work got subsumed within it. Am I reading that correctly?
Yes. And this is the larger point. You know, what I wanted to do, and I make this claim about Boaz as well, is that there's a larger, you know, Black intellectual tradition that I think Boaz benefited from. Certainly Herskovitz benefited from. Because if we're thinking about interrogations of 18th and 19th century thinking about biological difference and culture, you know, and difference in terms of culture, there were Black people already interrogating race in ways that would become more popularized and prominent in the 20th century, excuse me. And so for someone like Herskovitz, who he begins teaching at Howard University, right? Mm-hmm. And in that moment, at that moment, he actually argues against the existence of Africanisms in African-American culture over that time, right? So his time at HU, and then certainly the work of Carter G. Woodson, certainly Du Bois, these folks are ahead of Herskovitz in understanding continuity, the continuity between African-American culture and that of, you know, West and Central Africa, of course, with the West Indies tied in there as well. So it is a journey for Herskovitz to get to the point where he is making those arguments in support of that kind of cultural, those cultural links to the continent of Africa. And so in some ways, yes, I would agree with you that Herskovitz is more aligned there. And to, you know, to one of your earlier points about how Franz Boas was received by the Black press and the Black community, it's when Herskovitz gets to that point and he consistently makes these arguments in support of African cultural retention that he's widely embraced and certainly hailed as someone who's doing the good work for Black people in the United States.
You know, if I can just ask you to engage a little bit in your own subjective judgments, you know, mm-hmm. I feel like in the book, Boas comes off as being not quite as much a politically progressive figure as we'd like. Montague comes mm-hmm. across as quite active. I mean, I kind of feel mm-hmm. like he gets the Tony Hazard seal of approval, that, you know, that Franz Boas doesn't get. Mm-hmm. I mean, is that sounds right? Then how about Herskovitz, if you don't mind me just asking you to indulge your personal perceptions of these people?
Yeah, so I you know, in being so close to these folks for so long, and of course, my own positionality, my own training, I can just say flat out that I thought Ashley Montague was the coolest dude from day one, mm-hmm. from reading, you know, Man's Most Dangerous Myth to his work on the UNESCO Statements on Race. You know, the fact that he, you know, went to the Race Relations Institute at Fisk. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and I mean, they integrated for 2 weeks. Montague wasn't there for the entire 2 weeks, but they integrated that institute in Nashville, Tennessee. Okay.
Right.
I mean, so this is, and later on, of course, you know, it was multiple appearances on the Johnny Carson show and all of that. I just thought Montague was an awesome dude, but I thought that also that, and I think that his scholarship and his willingness to actually go down south and do those sorts of things, you know, it held up. He wasn't just a thinker. He was doing the things that Black people were doing physically with their bodies. So I would have him, you know, in one particular position, one particular space or place in terms of, you know, how progressive he was. I think Herskovitz's career was so different. His work for the U.S. government, the things that he was doing, attempting to institutionalize African studies, not just at Northwestern, but in universities around the country. It's clear to me that Herskovitz was not as active. To say that he wasn't as concerned, I don't think that would be fair, but he did not engage in the the types of the sorts of activism with one's body that Ashley Montague did.
Right. And you know, I can't remember whether it's in your book or the last book that I did, which for this podcast, which was also a little bit on Fisk, but like that integrated conference, people in Nashville were concerned that it was integrated. I mean, this is not something that happened in a room in a college campus and no one had heard about. I mean, they were worried about it in the non-academic community.
Yes. People called the police on on them. And this was a nightly occurrence that you know, local law enforcement was showing up because white citizens of Nashville would call the police on them. And I'll add that seeing the photographs, you know, not just in the classroom, not just the dining area, but they held dances. Like they were hanging out. They created an integrated setting at Fisk. And like I said, just so cool and really progressive, and knowing that the order of the day was Jim Crow segregation, and understanding that there was a certain potential for violence that accompanied Jim Crow segregation.
I think that emphasis on the body is really interesting. You know, I study the Pacific, and for the Pacific anthropologists who are not Pacific Islanders, these days when we think about what kind of discipline we want to build, you know, I think one of the things we focus a lot on is being in the same room, having people come to conferences, not just engaging in a shared discourse or a shared problematic, but engaging in that like embodied way of knowing people and being directly connected to them. So that resonated with me, I think.
It's such a challenge, and there's allyship, and then there's being a co-conspirator. And, you know, for me as a historian, understanding what the history of Black freedom has been about, it's been about facing that physical danger, right? It's one thing to have the intellectual engagement, but end of the day, you know, it's for me, Dr. King was radical because he was willing to be beaten and bloodied to make a point. So it is the body is so very important when we're talking about the fight, you know, the real fight for freedom for Black people and brown people.
Yeah. Well, you know, I guess this is going to be posted in the New Books in Anthropology podcast. So we should spend a couple of minutes talking about Margaret Mead and Ruth Benedict. you know, I'm not quite sure where to start. I'm, you know, people tend to run very hot and cold on Mead, and they always have, even when she was alive. I tend to run colder on her maybe than some people. Even you know, maybe because of the Pacific connection there as well. But am I right in saying that you feel like Benedict sort of had a pretty good account of structural racism, and did she sort of go farther than Boas by the point that time we get to her doing that book or her multiple books? I mean, maybe we should just start. She had this project, even though she herself did not study race, on publishing about race during World War II. And I believe, you'll tell me. Yeah, I guess it was during World War II, but then it got started before the U.S. entered the war, maybe. Tell me about that project. And is it true that she maybe had a more nuanced account of structural racism, or do I not remember that correctly?
No, so are we talking about the pamphlet?
Yeah, the race is a man, or I can't remember.
Yes. So this pamphlet project, it was to be kind of an educational guide for military personnel, and eventually as well as civilians. But it's a very, very short pamphlet, 30, 35 pages, I believe, in which she would, you know, lay out the kind of, well, her Boasian take on how race was understood at that moment, and cultural difference as well. And so I would say that that particular pamphlet, which stirred controversy among the military brass, there was an investigation by Congress. People were very upset about it. But in that pamphlet, she basically lays out kind of, you know, environmentalism. There are racial differences due to the environment. She didn't go as far in the pamphlet as she does in her later work. And some of the essays that she wrote but did not publish, and I believe I utilized one of them in that chapter, they were far more progressive, and she did indeed lay out an understanding of structural racism. I think in race, it's Race, Science, and Politics, the larger work of hers. She does some of that work on institutionalized racism as well. But the pamphlet, and this is what was, I want to say comical at times, because I did laugh reading some of the letters that were sent by, you know, members of Congress. And they were up in arms that, first of all, that a woman would have the gall to say that there were not innate racial differences that existed among the various races, and that each quote unquote race possessed the potential to develop their intellectual abilities and to create set of cultural practices that, again, potentially could be viewed as equal. Just the very notion of equal potentiality had members of Congress just on fire. And I chuckled a time or two reading through those letters. But I would say that Benedict did possess a deeper understanding of what racism was, particularly in a U.S. context, than Boas did.
And that's interesting too, because, you know, she was, you know, white Protestant from like what they call an old American family.
Yes.
Some Americans, like Native Americans, might not think of as that old, but
right.
So tell me about some of that that unwritten work where she's freed from having to be answerable to the public, and she can express herself a little bit more freely.
Yeah, the one piece that that stood out to me was very brief, I think 3 or 4 pages, but the title was "If I Were a Negro."
Mm.
And I know, right? So I see this. I'm sitting there at the, you know, at the desk in the archive at Vassar, and I see the folder, and okay, I open it. And I'm like, what is this? and so, you know, reading through it, and she kind of paints a picture of a 2 or 3 different scenarios: getting on an elevator if I were a Negro, walking down the street if I were a Negro. Right. And she, it's like she attempts to embody that, right? It's her effort to at least on a cognitive level understand, grapple with what it might feel like being Black in New York City in the late 1930s, early 1940s. And again, this is New York City. She's not talking about, you know, Birmingham. Yeah. Right. And it was fantastic way that she at least made the attempt. Right. And to take the time to write it for herself.
Yeah, it shows her to be such an empathetic character, which I think the biographies of her that have been written really, really, really show that side of her. I love your you make it sound so exciting to do archival work. I love your passion for that. You know, I've done this kind of work as well as a historical anthropologist, and I know when you talk about that moment where you look at the title on the folder and you flip out. You know, people who don't do this work, they don't understand how exciting it will be, or they will now when they listen to this interview. So if there are listeners out there who think that archival work sounds boring, now you can get a sense of how exciting it is and how much these people come to life for us. You know, I asked you earlier, maybe a little unfairly, to talk about your own personal opinions of these people. But for people who haven't done archival work, I mean, you get to know these people. You live with them. They're not abstract entities at all. You get to know their foibles and their weaknesses in a really, really real way.
Yes, indeed. And I'm reminded of it was my second trip to Vassar, and on one of, you know, you're winding down, you're exhausted, you have, you know, a few days left, and I was able to look through the box that contained the items in her purse at the moment that she passed away.
Wow.
Yes, yes, yes. And that box had been on my mind for, I am not exaggerating, years, because I read in Lois Banner's book about Mead and Benedict, she describes, I believe it's her, she describes the items in Ruth Benedict's purse. And so I have been thinking about that, you know, back in my mind, but I knew I had to look through that box. So I did that. And I believe there was a dry cleaning slip and, you know, some other ordinary, everyday, ordinary things. But the fact that I was able to look at those things, touch them, feel them, it's, I don't know, I suppose that's a metaphor for archival work. It's like you feel what was there.
Yeah, people forget, to get back to this theme of the body. Archival work is embodied work. Working with text is embodied work, you know, and it can hit you when you do that kind of thing.
Yeah.
That piece of hers, If I Were a Negro, it was not published by Margaret Mead in the Anthropologist at Work volume. It just lay there until you found it.
I don't believe Mead included it. I can double check, but I don't believe. And I think that's a part of the reason I got chills when I found it.
Well, you know, you should definitely find a place to publish it somewhere. That sounds absolutely remarkable.
Yeah, I would love to.
Well, look, I've taken up a lot of your time. I don't want to keep you for too much longer, but before we go, can you tell me about what your future projects are that you're thinking about doing now that you've gotten done with this book?
Yeah, so I mentioned a bit of my family history earlier. I want to begin with an article chronicling the experiences of the Narragansett during World War II. Of course, my grandfather and great grandpa will appear in that, but there's, you know, in addition to the family history, there's something to explore in terms of historical erasure within the context of racial categories. And what I mean by that is my great-grandfather and grandfather, the extended family, on the census records from 1870 through 1930, the way they're categorized changes. So in 1870, they were categorized as Indian. In 1920, they were Negro. In 1930, they were Negro, right? But then my grandfather's draft card has him as Indian. So I'm trying to think through you know, U.S. government policy. What was the state of Rhode Island doing with, in terms of, you know, the Narragansett population? Is this really a question of a misunderstanding of racial categories, or was there something? Is there something to an attempt by the state to erase the Narragansett people, right? Their very identity and their history by categorizing them as quote Negro. So this is the one of the big questions that has just stuck with me since I began going through the census records. And it's, you know, definitely early moments in my thinking about the project, but I feel like that needs to be done. It needs to be, I need to do it for myself. I need to do it for my father and certainly the, you know, the next generation of Hazards. I need to do that.
Yeah. Well, as I said, you know, these projects that come from deep places in our biographies, I think those are always the ones that you're going to be able to pour yourself into and really get mm-hmm. something good out of it. So that sounds like a great project. I look forward to reading it.
Thank you. I'm excited once, you know, things calm down.
Yeah, in our copious free time, right? I mean, what could go wrong?
Right.
After 2020?
Yes.
Okay, well, Anthony Hazard, author of Boazians at War, thanks for being on the podcast today.
Thank you so much, Alex.
This has been an episode of the New Books Network. Please go ahead and subscribe if you want to find some more New Books content. And until next time, take care.